listener production.
If we went to zero net migration and kept that for 10 years, deaths would rapidly then, after 10 or 15 years, exceed births.
G'day and welcome to The Good Oil. I'm Scott Phillips. Now, hopefully by now you're familiar with the phrase The Good Oil, but if you're not, giving someone The Good Oil is giving them the good stuff, the important stuff, and the real stuff, which, as you know, is what we do on this podcast. We talk to entrepreneurs, executives, and experts, the people who know what's going on and the people who make things happen. As always, today's guest is someone who does really know what's going on and a very, can I say controversial? I think I can, policy area. But he is the expert, the expert. Abul Rizvi was a senior official in the Department of Immigration from the early 1990s to 2007 when he left from the role of Deputy Secretary. He was awarded the Public Service Medal and the Centenary Medal for services to development and implementation of immigration policy, including in particular the reshaping of Australia's intake to focus on skilled migration. He also has completed a PhD on Australia's immigration policies. Dr. Abul Rizvi, welcome to The Good Oil.
Thank you, Scott.
Mate, thank you so much for being with me. I got to say, you and I know each other a little just on Twitter. Twitter can be a real cesspit if it's used badly and is by some people. If you use it well, it can be an absolute joy. The people I get to talk to, hear from, listen to, learn from is just fantastic, mate. And that's how I came across you in the first instance. You have been absolutely brilliant in terms of basically just giving people the facts, commenting on actually what's going on, which frankly in policy in general, and I've got to say immigration policy in particular, is super, super, super necessary right now. Mate, before we get into any of that though, let's go all the way back. How do you end up working in the Department of Immigration? How do you end up being the Deputy Secretary?
Well, geez. So I started in the public service in the early 1980s. I started in the Department of Defence. I then moved to the Department of Housing. And so I did an economics degree, accounting and economics at the ANU. And I also did a graduate diploma in public policy at the ANU. And that was the basis of me entering the public service. I worked for a couple of departments. I then moved to the Department of Finance. I worked there for 10 years. I also had a posting at the Malaysian Treasury for 2 years, advising them on developing budget processes. So that's where my background was in government budgets. I was recruited out of the Department of Finance into the CFO role at Immigration. After a couple of years of that, I said, I'd like to do some policy. And so they put me in charge of the migration program. So you can do that.
You're careful what you wish for, mate.
Yeah. So I managed that until 2007, and I gradually got promoted through the system. Somebody must have thought I did a good job. And I ended up Deputy Secretary before I moved to the Department of Communications. And for 7 years, I worked looking after things like broadcasting policy and internet regulation.
There you go. That is a heck of a career. You did mention to me you're now retired, but you are still in huge, huge demand for commentary. I should share with our listeners too, mate, your Twitter profile. You describe yourself as population and immigration policy nut and mad Collingwood supporter. I'll leave the latter, mate, because I don't want anyone to not like you as a result. That's not nice. But I do want to speak a little bit about population policy, mate, because it has been probably, my suspicion, well, let me editorialise before I then ask you the questions, because my suspicion is this could become a significant political issue. Now, you and I aren't going to talk about the politics of it, because frankly, that's for other people to, you know, shout and scream and carry on. But it's why I wanted to have this conversation, mate, because I think my biggest concern is if it doesn't get addressed responsibly, not necessarily by you and I, but hopefully we're adding to the conversation, but by our politicians, it leaves the field pretty open for those who would mischievously misuse immigration policy. And I think that would be a horrible, horrible outcome for public policy, horrible outcome for politics as well. So that's why I wanted to chat about it, mate. But to set this up, the headlines suggest we had somewhere between 500,000 and 600,000 people come to Australia over the last or a 12-month period. Most, I think it might be September quarter or December quarter now. That's the size of a Canberra. There are plenty of people, I've been one of them, who said, I'm not sure that given the current economic circumstances, and your economics background is super useful here as well, that that's a great idea. But I'm shooting from the hip here, and that's why you're here. So I'm just going to start with a very, very broad question, mate, which is, how would you describe the current state of immigration policy? Again, not politics, but policy, when it comes to the right settings for the country?
In terms of immigration levels, Australia has traditionally managed that on the basis of what's known as the migration program, which, for the nerds listening, counts the number of permanent visas issued, irrespective of whether the person was issued the visa whilst they were living overseas or whether they were living in Australia. Because the vast majority of people coming in under the migration program came in from overseas, traditionally, that was fine. But that's no longer the case. Over the last 20 years, the vast majority of people who are given a visa under the migration program are already here. They've been here a long time. Most of them are former students. And as a result of that, managing immigration levels and therefore ultimately population levels, using the migration program alone does not work. I've been trying to convince ministers of that it doesn't work for about 20 years. Utter failure. Yeah. Utter failure.
Not your fault, just quietly. Ministers aren't always the most, they're always open to listening, but keep going.
There are two main reasons ministers don't want to set a long-term target for net migration. Ministers sometimes will pretend they do, but they don't actually. So when Claire O'Neill was recently asked, are your forecasts of net migration, you know, the Prime Minister stood up and said, we're going to get net migration back down to pre-pandemic levels. She was asked, is that a target? And she said, no, it's an estimate. Which obviously means, if we hit it, you know, we'll boast about it. And if we don't hit it, we've got an excuse.
Well, so it was an estimate. That's right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And you think, will Aussies really be sucked in by that? You're kidding, aren't you? So, and there are two reasons why ministers refuse to set a long-term target. The first is, whatever target you set, no one will agree with. Either they'll say, oh, that's way too high, or they'll say, oh, that's way too low. And the usual suspects will line up on either side. Okay? The BCA and all the employer bodies will say, way too low, grumble, grumble, grumble. And all the anti-immigration groups will say, you're kidding. We can't have one that high. So, and politicians hate setting a target where no one agrees because they're just caught.
You're in a hiding to nothing, yeah.
Yeah, you're in a hiding to nothing. The second problem is that it's really hard to manage net migration.
Tell us why, mate, because that seems like a strange thing to say if we, and God love Operation Sovereign Borders, but we have this pretense that, and John Howard famously will decide who comes and how they come or whatever he said, you would think we can say, well, hang on, we know who gets here by boat, we know who gets here by plane, we can simply shut the door at the appropriate point. Why is that not possible?
Okay, two reasons. The first is what net migration counts is movement of people. And this is the movement of people who already have authority to either enter Australia or leave Australia. And once you've been given the authority, unless you take the authority away, you can't predict when they're going to come in or when they're going to leave. It's very hard to do that. The second is net migration includes Aussie citizens. And government, other than that short period during COVID, governments generally don't control whether you can go have a holiday in Bali or
not. And whether you stay or come back, I suppose, too, at some level too.
And whether you stay or come back, you get offered a job and you think, oh, yeah, that's all right. I'll do that. In fact, in most years, Aussie citizens contribute negatively to net migration. More Aussies every year leave the country long term than come back.
That's fascinating.
So we have a net negative contribution from Aussies to net migration. Having said that, yes, I know it's hard. But because it's so overwhelmingly important, you have to swallow the hard and do the hard work. That's the argument that I've put. Not a very convincing argument, and no minister agreed.
I think it's a very convincing argument, mate. Getting someone to agree is a different thing. I think that is doing hard things has not been popular in politics over the last little while. Well, the last long while. Again, we can bracket both major parties, and I'll do that. You don't have to. You feel free to say what you want or don't say what you want, but I'll happily say they're both ducking a lot of hard things at the moment. When we think about I've tried really hard on Twitter to talk about population policy rather than immigration policy, because it gets to become immigration and then it's the immigrants and then it's their fault, and then and it gets very personal, and as you say, the usual groups line up on both sides and it gets ugly fast. I've had some reasonably rubbish replies on Twitter that I've muted, blocked or otherwise addressed. But that being said, mate, I think that's the crux of this. And you say you're a population and immigration nut, so I'm going to ask you the harder question. Maybe it's not. I would love us to have a conversation as a nation about the population that we want to have at a point in time, pick your point, 2050, 2080, 2030, whatever you want to do, and say, all right, we've got issues with housing. We've got issues with both availability and affordability. We've got issues with infrastructure and the cost and the ROI of that. We've got issues with the environmental damage that our current population is doing, let alone more. And I've got to say, mate, I'm not entirely sure how much bigger Australia would want to be on those criteria. Now, when I say that, I literally mean not sure. It's not a weasel word of saying I think it's bad. I just don't know. You know, we think about droughts and water restrictions and stuff we've had in the past. But I'm going to ask you the question, because I'm going to put you on the hot seat rather than me. Do you start with a sense of how big Australia could be, should be, needs to be, or do you start with a reasonable ability to absorb population growth? If you were, let's give you the job of immigration minister, or maybe more importantly, home affairs or prime minister, who gets to combine all of these issues and say, based on everything that we know, how big should Australia be, or how quickly should we grow? Just conceptually, put a number on if you want, but conceptually, how do you approach that question?
Okay, and it is the ultimate question, and it's a good question. And I think it's really, really important that ministers, and the Prime Minister in particular, spend some time explaining the answer or his answer to that question. Now, if I was in his position, there's a few things that I would explain to the Australian public. The first is, over the next 50 years, the vast majority of developed nations, including our major trading partners, will shrink dramatically.
In population terms?
They will shrink. China will shrink. Japan will shrink. Europe will shrink. Unless they do something dramatically different on current policy settings, they will shrink. With China, three things have happened. Their fertility rate has gone through the floor, and nothing that the dictator of China can say or do will change that. The second is, China is a very rapidly aging population. So even if you got the fertility rate up, you've got too many oldies to have babies. The third problem China has is that it is disproportionately male, and men still don't have babies. And so China is not going to change, unless they dramatically change their immigration policy, which they're trying to do. There's nothing they can do. They will age and shrink.
In Europe and Japan, similar problems, right? The aging of the population and low fertility in the, I call it developed world, I think that's the right term, simply means that absent meaningful immigration, these populations will shrink.
Absolutely. And whilst India is some way behind China on this, it is heading in the same direction. Its fertility is falling, and falling rapidly. India's big advantage is it's younger, and its fertility fell later. But it's headed in the same direction. So Australians need to understand we will be a country that will be very different to everybody else, because on all current indications, we will continue to grow for the rest of this century because of immigration, not because of our fertility rate. And what that will mean is we will age, but we will age more slowly than everybody else. So that's the broad demographic context. The second thing I would point out to Australians is that both those pushing for higher immigration and lower immigration is that trying to get net migration below about 150,000 per annum, given the nature of the Australian economy at the moment and the way it's structured, below 150,000 per annum is really, really hard unless you have a really, really, really weak labour market. That's that people are leaving the country in droves.
Right. I will ask you to describe that, mate. What is it about the 150-ish that is so horrible? If we're to 150, what negative consequences would we suffer as a country?
Let's assume our labour market remains strong. And if our labour market remains strong, because of the ageing of the population, there will be many skill areas we simply won't be able to fill. You know, people say, train more Aussies, train more Aussies. Yes, by all means, train more Aussies, and we should do that, but you will never fill those gaps. We will never fill the gaps in terms of our shortage of nurses, given the rate of ageing. We will always import nurses. We, for the last 30 years, have been importing nurses. If you've been to a hospital, you will know we've been importing nurses. You don't need the data. We are importing aged care workers. There isn't anything we can do about that. We're going to do that. We just have to find the best way to do it, not stuff it up, which is a high risk. But so our shortage of teachers is massive. It will continue. Just ask any public school. Ask any private school. They struggle, even though they pay much better wages. They struggle to attract. So a strong labour market will mean we will inevitably have to draw in people from overseas. And on my calculations, getting that below 150,000 is really hard. We have our universities that are heavily, heavily dependent on overseas students. That's another complicated set of issues. But our universities are not going to disappear. And the fact that they are heavily dependent on overseas students is not going to disappear. Our tourism industry is heavily dependent on working holiday makers. If you go to Far North Queensland or Alice Springs or Broome, you will find in every bar there'll be a working holiday maker pulling the beers. That is not going to go away. And any minister who says, no, we're going to close down working holiday makers, you just wait for the screams. So they're the kinds of factors. Another one is Aussies travel a lot. And young Aussies who travel a lot just fall in love a lot.
That's right. Yes.
And they get married.
Yes.
And they want to live in Australia and they want to bring their overseas spouse to Australia. We're not going to stop.
So it seems to me that you've taken a very pragmatic approach. I would suggest to you any of those things you've identified are absolutely stoppable. The question is, at what cost slash expense for the economy or the society that we're in? In other words, we could say, well, sorry, guys, not enough nurses. You have to deal with the nurses shortage. You're not going to bring them in. Or you say, sorry, you or your parents or your grandparents are going to be in a nursing home where there's insufficient numbers of staff. And you can say, well, I want that because of low immigration, but you've got to make that choice. And those aren't social choices you think we're prepared to make. Is that a reasonable way to describe that?
Absolutely. Look, no one wants granny to die in the nursing home prematurely.
So on that basis, mate, that suggests that the population policy ends up being a very pragmatic, slow, steady growth over time simply because of the structure of the economy. At some point, we could have a 50, 60-year plan if governments ever thought more than an election term and say, by then we would like to be X, Y, or Z, either triple or halve the immigration intake for those reasons, as long as we structured an economy appropriately. But as you say, the chance of that happening are not very high. So let's then, so if you were...
Well, there are limits at the other end too.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've only talked about the low end.
Yes.
Every time net migration gets much above 250, 280,000, our infrastructure struggles. Our housing struggles. We don't build fast enough. Doesn't matter what promises people make. We just don't seem to build fast enough. And we don't build the infrastructure fast enough. Doesn't matter what promises are made. And our ability to get government services, health, education, et cetera, delivering to that rate of increase, we struggle. And the business community, whenever I say that to them, says, the government should put their fingers and fix it.
Yeah, that's right.
Sure. But it
so
doesn't
on,
get fixed.
On a, let's pick 250 just because you've used that number. And again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so feel free to change the number. On 250, let's go out 40 years because my math is easier that way. That adds 10 million people to the Australian population, which is a 30-ish, 35% more than we have today. In theory, another 10 years after that, and 10 years after that, and 10 years after that, there is a. I think it's axiomatic that at some point, there's not enough land for the people who would like to live in Australia and vice versa. And that could be 400 years away for all we know. And that shouldn't ever be a rationale to change something now necessarily other than get the glide path roughly right. Again, go to that population policy question. Do you think it's, at least in the medium term, less likely, less reasonable, less realistic, frankly, to have a population target than a net immigration target for the reasons you've outlined? In other words, the population outcome is simply the result of the forces you've just discussed. Is that the best way to approach population policy more broadly?
You could. One thing it's worth understanding is that our rate of natural increase interact with our immigration policy.
Yeah, right, of course.
Okay,
yeah, yeah.
So the two are working and they're interacting. They're not sort of independent of each other. So if we went to zero net migration and kept that for 10 years, deaths would rapidly then after 10 or 15 years exceed births.
Because the population's aging without bringing younger immigrants.
Exactly.
So it sounds like 250 is the right number in your mind.
250 is 250 will still put strain on infrastructure and housing and government service delivery. And we've got to think about, well, okay, if you're prepared to go to 250 and use that as your target, you then have to answer the question, how are you going to deal with your infrastructure, housing, government service delivery, et cetera, problems?
You're an accountant by nature or by background, sorry. You think very clearly about the economics as well as the public policy. And I'm always very clear, by the way, although I'm an investor by trade, to say that the economy serves a society, not the other way around. So I always try and make that the right starting point. But that being said, the things we've just talked about then, the recent surge in net overseas migration for very understandable reasons, maybe something should have been done about them, but either way, very understandable reasons, does put that pressure on. We have a vacancy rate for housing, for example, less than 1%, some say 0.8, 0.9%. And to be fair, people who come in are sometimes the spouses of people who already have a home, or they come in families of 3, 4, 5, or 6. So you can't simply say that many people has that many houses. It does strike me, though, Matt, as somewhat, I don't know what the right word is, and maybe I'll just avoid the pejorative, but it's unfortunate, let me say that at a time when you have really, really low vacancy rates, we have some of the highest population increases. Is that a fair comment? And again, I don't mean it to be a loaded comment, but it does seem that if we're, and let's also put on the record, I'll say for me anyway, I won't say for you, there is an element of national, you know, Australia first about this, and that can be uncomfortable with a lot of people. You simply say, well, there are people poorer and worse off, and should we accept them? Some people say yes, some people say no. So there's an element of, you know, do we look after our people or others? And that's a really difficult moral question. In that context, it seems like the number of people coming to the country in a net sense has overwhelmed those things you talked about, housing, infrastructure, government's ability to serve. Is that fair, and was that avoidable?
I'll say two things about that. The first is our population today, if it hadn't been for COVID, would actually be higher than it is at the moment.
Oh, wow. Okay. Because of the gap in migration over the COVID period. Right.
Yes. Because of what COVID did. If you look at the 2019 budget, it projected population higher than we actually had. And you're not going to tell me we had a housing plan all ready to go.
Of course we did. Haven't you heard our politicians? Of course we did.
The second
thing
I'd say,
I just want to kind of underscore that. You're saying we would have been in this position either way.
Well, it was, yeah, if it wasn't for COVID, we were headed in this direction anyway. And we didn't have an adequate housing plan or an adequate infrastructure plan or an adequate service delivery plan. What happened straight after COVID is three things. The first was we put in place a heap of policies during COVID that were designed to keep people in Australia for as long as possible. Immediately after COVID, we put in place policies, including things like fee-free applications, et cetera, which just stoked demand massively. That was under the coalition. Under the Labor government, the way they responded was, hang on, we've got this massive labor shortage, and everyone, you know, every man and his dog's complaining about labor shortages.
Yes.
You'll remember 2022. And so what the Labor government did was clear lots of backlogs, which had to be cleared. Backlogs are bad, but you have to clear them. Having growing long-term backlogs is not a solution.
There's no point pretending that. Exactly. It's just either way, yeah.
They had to be cleared. The government increased the migration program, but that didn't actually increase the number of people coming because the bulk of the people in the migration program
right,
were already here. They just changed visa status. But because of that, in late 2022, when by October it was clear, October of 2022, I wrote about it in October and said, net migration's booming here. And I am sure, and I was convinced at that point, the government would act. Because it was obvious. It was booming, it was getting out of control.
I'm going to ask you to speculate. And again, if this gets too close to politics rather than policy, feel free not to. But if you were a government that realised you had a problem, you wrote about it in October 2022, any smart immigration minister or immigration department is reading your article and saying, hey, we're all saying there's an issue here. He's a smart guy. Even if we don't agree with him entirely, we should at least look at this and make sure we're aware of what he's saying. There seems no excuse for not knowing. They chose not to act. From a policy or politics, I suppose, I guess I'm going to have to ask you about both, perspective, why didn't they do more? What could they or should they have done?
I think there were two reasons they didn't act faster. One was they were still drowning in the, geez, we've got labour shortages and you've got to do something. You've got to remember, in the second half of 2022, yeah, they were being belted by Peter Dutton for not increasing immigration fast
enough. He might forget that when he starts bagging them about too much immigration, but yes, I think it's probably right.
Well, he's a very forgetful chap, Mr. Dutton, I've found.
Yeah, fair enough.
So if they had started to tighten, they would have got the reverse hit on them from the business community and from the opposition. You've tightened too quickly. We need people. What are you doing? And so there was a delay. The second thing is, I get the impression Mr. Albanese has excessively learned the lessons of Kevin Rudd. I was in the public service when Kevin Rudd was prime minister, and what we had was frantic decision making. Things were going everywhere. We were changing things all over the place, and the opportunity to think things through was really difficult. On really, really big issues, we were just rushing. And I think Albanese learned and said, we're not going to do that. But he's gone to the other extreme. They've put in place processes that are now just far, far too slow. There were days when immigration ministers could make decisions because they were the immigration minister, they had the legal authority to do it, and they did it. We've now put in place processes that immigration ministers can't make those decisions. They have to go through lengthy, lengthy processes, and the delays just make it very difficult to get things done. So we've gone from the frantic to the glacial.
If we look forward then at immigration policy moving forward, we've talked about a couple of different numbers, mate. We've talked about 150, we've talked about 250. I'm going to ask you to put your policy, population, immigration and economist hat on, and maybe just general public policy in terms of the other social impacts, positive and negative. And I want to be really clear that we've talked a lot about too much immigration, and you've been very generous talking about both, but I want to be very clear that there are absolute, very clear positives from immigration as well. I reckon you made the point about Australia's population growing. Sorry, quick editorial. I reckon immigration is a superpower for Australia. When we have so many people around the world who are desperate to come here and we get to effectively choose, and I'll ask you about the makeup of immigration in a minute, but if we get to choose, say, hey, we've got all these people knocking down our door, we literally get to pick and choose should we wish, we can make it in terms of the individuals and then the overall impact of those individuals, it can be an absolute superpower. So moving forward, given all that, and again, let me make you immigration minister for a day or a week or a year or as long as you want, what would you target, estimate, set, forecast, lock in as the right level of net overseas migration, immigration for the Australian continent?
Look, that requires a fairly detailed study and that sort of stuff. And I think you said 250. I think somewhere between 200 and 250 is probably fine. The demographic benefit of immigration in slowing the rate of aging is strong at about 200 and then gradually gets weaker. The contribution of net migration to slowing the rate of aging after about 200 gets slower. And that varies depending on the assumptions you make and that sort of stuff. My supervisor, who is the greatest demographer Australia's ever had. So let's assume that's the number. You know, we could debate the number, but let's assume it's somewhere between 200 and 250. The question is, how do you design immigration policy to get the best benefit out of that 200 to 250?
That was my next question. So now I'm going to make you do exactly that, Abul, if you wouldn't mind. How would you design that immigration policy?
The first thing I would do is to say we need to rethink the objective of the overseas student program because it's the dominant driver of long-term population. And we have for too long thought about it as revenue, tuition fee revenue for universities. If you compare the benefit of tuition fee revenue with someone who's going to work in Australia for the next 40 years as an Australian citizen, which one do you think is more important? Clearly, the objective of the overseas student program should not be primarily about tuition fee revenue. It should be about the selection of future Australian citizens. And that then changes two things. One, you have to have regulations that say, well, how do we select the best students? Because at the moment, the universities say, hey, if you've got the money, we've got the seat. And I think government should say, well, you know, your objectives are not in the national interest. We are going to design this in the national interest, not in the interest of universities. The second thing you would do, I would put the feet of the employer lobby groups to the floor and say, you keep telling us you need skilled people, more skilled people in Australia, and you say we've got skill shortages. Okay, let's assume you are right. Let's assume, and I think the data shows that's right. And we also know, because you keep telling us, the best people to select skilled migrants are employers. We agree with that. I mean, I was extensively involved in designing the points test, but the points test should not be the predominant way we bring skilled migrants to Australia. Governments are not good at selecting skilled migrants. The best people to select are employers. And I would say to them, look, we will streamline how the employer sponsorship system works, which this government has done to its credit. We now have, if you are an employer who employs someone at more than $135,000 per annum, wow, you get your visa in 7 days.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's not complain about flow processing and crap like that. The other thing that employers complain about is the government keeps changing the rules such that the person I sponsor, after I've spent all this money recruiting them, could leave me. And I would say to that employer, the job of ensuring the employee keeps working for you is not the job of the government.
Exactly. Yes.
That's your job, mate. And I would say we must significantly expand at the expense of these other categories. So we shrink the points-tested categories and we say to employers, this is demand-driven. You recruit them, you identify them, you employ them, and you retain them. Your job, mate. And the employer bodies will initially agree to that and then do nothing and then go back to complaining that we don't have enough. You know, I'm not talking about today's employer bodies. I'm talking about the ones 30 years ago. They were doing the same thing and they haven't changed. They spent too much time lobbying and not enough time actually doing the hard yards.
Would that, those two changes, would you apply a cap to those two categories? Would you set the criteria such that it has a natural, you know, soft cap because only a certain number of people meet those criteria? How would we functionally get to a targeted level of immigration by making those two changes?
So we have the permanent migration cap at 190,000. We have about 35,000 notional places for employer-sponsored visas. We have another 30-odd thousand for points-tested visas. I would say to the employers, go for your life, and we will just keep shrinking the points-tested category until it's completely abolished. We can rethink the issue once you get to that point. But given that you have failed to get to that point for 40 years, I don't fear a problem.
So you give them what they want, and then when it naturally just atrophies anyway, we're okay.
They will fall short anyway, don't worry.
And the student one, is that done by setting a level high enough that it naturally ends up with a small number of people? Yeah.
You set an ATAR level, and you can, because every one of our source countries does the same thing for their domestic students. So they have the equivalent of an ATAR, which we could use. And I would set the ATAR levels in two ways. One, you make sure the overseas students you get would be as well performing in the same course as an Aussie student. And secondly, I would set the ATAR level at a level that's going to help me deliver the net migration target. And I could raise or lower that.
And that seems to me the thing that governments have avoided, having a sense of how you want to get to an Australian population level or a growth of the Australian population. You take the fertility level, you take that lever and you say, well, we want to have growth in the population of this. Migration, as unfair as it might seem if you're a potential immigrant, is the balancing item because it has to be. You can't control fertility without doing draconian things. And so you simply choose that and make that work. That's the most frustrating thing about this whole conversation, of all for what it's worth, is that it does strike me as the most easily changed, it's not going to be the most, one of the most easily changed impacts economically, socially, for all of the things that we talked about, all the reasons why we would want to do that, for infrastructure, for education, for all those things, for housing. It's so easy to do. It's why it makes it, some problems are really hard to solve. This one seems very, very simple to solve. And I'm sure it's not as simple as I think it is, or I'm sure there's more complexity that you haven't told us about because your knowledge runs deep. But broadly speaking, this feels really, really solvable and very manageable in a way that retains the integrity of the system, retains the integrity and growth in the economy, avoids some of the uglier potential fallout of a public debate about migration and migrants. Is it just political will? I'm not trying to ask you to be political about it, but given what you've just said, if they made you department secretary tomorrow, you'd have the policy out by Friday and we'd be in the right path. I have to assume there's some just simple unwillingness or a different set of priorities or something that's stopping us doing exactly that.
I had a talk to a minister about this in recent times. I won't name which one. And the fear of what happened when Kevin Rudd said, I believe in a big Australia, is overwhelming. And hence, we can't do the bleeding obvious.
Could they not do it, though, without the statement? I mean, to your point, they could make those changes. You wouldn't need a big grand, if that is true, you know, Paul Keating famously also said the recession we had to have, and there are things that politicians learn not to say. They could still have the outcome, should they choose, with whatever messaging the spinners decided to put in their mouths. Is it still the fear of the political reality or the mess that's made, or the kick up of the fuss that's made by vested interests and opposition politicians?
Because to put the policy into place, there will be winners and losers. And the losers will scream blue murder.
As is always the case, we've lost the willingness to have those fights worth fighting, unfortunately.
Yep. And this government in particular doesn't want to have that fight.
Mate, let's go to our favourite questions as we wrap up. You're obviously someone who's deeply, deeply in the immigration population space, but I am curious what else, or maybe including that, what you've been watching, listening, reading, streaming. What's keeping you occupied when you're not thinking about immigration?
Oh, geez. I'm a sports nut. If I can do anything related to sport, I will do it.
Excellent.
So I play golf.
Right.
I play a lot of golf. I played golf yesterday. I won my pennants match 2-1.
Hey, well done.
Very happy with that.
Well done.
Yeah, that was good.
What's the handicap?
It's blown out a bit.
Okay.
It's out to 10 now.
Oh, that's still very, very good.
Ages catching up, mate. I can't get off the tee very far anymore.
Fair enough.
So I played a lot of cricket when I was growing up. So I watch a lot of cricket. My wife reads voraciously. She is an extraordinary reader. And she often tells me what to read, and I read what my wife tells me what to read.
That's a very, very good life choice, mate. It makes for a happy life. Obviously, we've talked about a lot of immigration population trends. What trends are you watching, mate, either in this space or anything else? What's fascinating you about the way the world's evolving?
I'm very fearful about what's happening in the United States and in a number of countries in Europe. I'm fearful that we are gradually trending again, and these things, I think, in the globe go in trends. We are again trending towards a belief in the authoritarian leader, you know, the guy, and it's almost always a guy, sometimes a woman, but usually a guy, who somehow people think, well, if we give him all the powers in the world, no checks and balances, he'll do a great job. I think, oh, God, surely we don't believe that, do we?
It kind of goes hand in hand with the young people's lack of belief in democracy and capitalism. And as much as they both have their own failures, there is something about the distance from the last crisis that makes you a bit complacent. I'm also, I agree with you in terms of the authoritarian populist. I shouldn't blame the victim necessarily, but I'm also mindful that those who aren't in that camp, who aren't doing a good enough job of actually solving the problems that the authoritarians get to then pretend they have answers for, even if they don't, it may not be fair to say, well, you know, it's you know, if the person exists, it's not the other people's fault that he exists or she exists, but there is an element of the best way to resolve that is to actually do a better job and not give that person room and space, which again is not to excuse that those authoritarians in the slightest, but I do think there's another way to resolve it, which frankly the rest of us have an obligation to try and prosecute, because if we don't, then we know what can happen, as you rightly point out.
As a public servant, a former public servant, I have to say, good, successful public policy is a slow burn. It takes time. To absolutely bugger things up doesn't take much time at all.
And we may have seen that from time to time. Speaking of which, mate, you did spend a career in the public service, and I thank you for that. Public servants get a bad rap, but public servants keep the country running. What advice would you give someone who was interested in a job in public service?
If you're going into the public service and you're thinking you're going in it in order to make money, forget it. That's not what... If you don't have a belief in public service as delivering good things for Australia, if that's not the core reason you're going in, you're in the wrong job. Try something.
Good advice. And, mate, you talked about being fearful of some things, but I'm an optimist by nature. You strike me as a happy bloke. Maybe you're an optimist, maybe not. If you are an optimist, what are you optimistic about?
I am optimistic that the institutions, the core institutions in Australia and around the world in places like the US and the UK, will temper the urges of the authoritarians and will keep them in control. That's what I'm optimistic about. People look at that High Court decision that was made in immigration last year, and everyone is shock, horror, you know, murderers let out of detention, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Frankly, I looked at it the other way. I said, the High Court has made a decision that says punishment in Australia is determined by the judicial system, the rule of law, and it is not determined by a minister. I thought, isn't that a great thing to say?
I 100% agree, mate. I don't think it's great we have some people in society we'd rather not have, but the rule of law must always be
paramount.
Yeah,
and absolutely. The risks these people pose are manageable. Losing the rule of law is not manageable.
That is a wonderful way to finish, mate. I really appreciate your time. How can people get more from you, mate? Obviously, Twitter is where you and I have interacted. Is that the best place to hear and see what you're sharing?
Yeah. I write for all sorts of different people. I'm a bit of a, you know, anyone who wants me to write, I write for. It doesn't really matter. As a retired public servant, I have that luxury. But follow me on Twitter and I will post what I write most of the time.
There you go. You really do need to follow Abul Rizvi on Twitter. He is at Rizvi Abul. It's RizviAbul. He is a spectacular follow, as you've heard over the last 45 minutes or 50 minutes. Very, very smart, erudite, thoughtful bloke who really does put policy first. And I've got to say, one of the great things about Twitter is people like Abul, and it is a real antidote to what else you can sometimes get in the media or just from our shoddy politicians. So do make sure, please, do yourselves a favour. If you've listened to this podcast and you've got to this point, I know it's because you value Abul's insight, so do that. Abul, all that remains is for me to say thank you for joining me for The Good Oil.
Fantastic. Good on you, Scott. Thanks very much, mate.
This podcast is hosted by me, Scott Phillips, produced by Ed Gooden, and imaged by Link Kelly.